Drum roll, please. Episode 256 of the podcast is live. That's how we have to do everything from this point forward.
Live? Or
no,
just like that?
Like you just did.
All right.
Drum roll.
I like it.
The announcement. And we're going to do that with literally every episode henceforth from this moment.
We should take a note because we're going to forget.
I'll definitely forget. This episode is brought to you by our amazing sponsors. If you go to energyislovepodcast.com right now, stop what you're doing and go there. You will see a tab up top and or on the side, depending on if you're looking at it on your phone or a computer. But the tab is titled Sponsors. Lo and behold, you click on that tab and you see all the sponsors of the podcast. Companies like Love Good Fats and Buddha Gear.
And there's Built Bar.
And Built Bar. And Tree Tribe. And that's literally all that are there. But you can go learn more about the sponsors there. Also, click on those links to those sponsors. Go pick up some stuff. And a portion of your purchase comes back to the podcast. And we reinvest it directly into this podcast to help reach, grow, expand, and cover the costs of everything that we do. So much, right? The other thing that we would like, the other thing that we ask, the other thing that really is only, it's not even necessary. You don't have to do anything if you listen to this podcast. You don't even have to enjoy it, although I think we encourage you to, and you probably do enjoy it if you're listening. But tell somebody about the podcast. That is kind of how we've grown from day one, just in this real organic way of people talking about it and sharing it with their friends and family and people that they think might be interested. So that's your challenge this week. Go find somebody out there that you think might like this podcast and might benefit from listening and tell them about this show. Episode 256 with
Matsu.
Yeah, we had such a great time interviewing this guy. So Matsu hit us up on social media. He is the owner of the Yoga Pit up in Brigham City. If you're not from Utah, that's a town in Utah. But we've linked to his Instagram account in the show notes. You can go find out a little bit more about his yoga studio. But he had a really fascinating story. He grew up here in Utah. And in his early 20s, he went there for a while.
It sounded like
for the summer, right? What would that be called? Visited? No, that sounds like a vacation. Anyways, he went to India because... And he tells this whole story in the podcast, and it's really fascinating. But he fell in love with kind of Eastern traditions, Vedic ancient traditions and teachings, and it's helped steer his life. And part of that was going to India. And that was a really beautiful story that he shared, as well as just this wealth of information that Stephanie and I both were kind of at a loss in regards to. I mean, wouldn't you say, babe, it was a lot of stuff that we may have had the slightest understanding of, or at least the existence of it out there in the sphere of the universe, per se. But I learned a lot.
I learned a lot.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's a great episode. We cannot thank you enough, Matsu, for coming out and being on the podcast. Go to the show notes now. Find him on Instagram. He's also got a YouTube channel, and we link to that in the show notes as well. What's the YouTube channel?
Revolution of Sound.
Yeah. Go check it out. He's doing some great work and spreading the message of love in his own special way. So we appreciate it and we appreciate him. Sit back, relax, and enjoy, folks.
You're listening to the Energy is Love podcast.
I have to laugh because we used to record outside before we moved in here.
Really?
Yeah. We'd set up outside and we have a nice backyard.
I can go shut that window. It's okay. Open.
It's not a big deal, but it's funny because every time we would record outside, that neighbor's dog seemed like that was the time that they would come out and bark. So
classic.
Yeah.
That always happens.
Yeah.
I record audiobooks and I've noticed that anytime I do, that's when the most noise will happen, despite everything always being so quiet.
Right. It's when you need everything peaceful and relaxing and quiet that the... everything else comes, yeah.
Time to make some noise.
Exactly.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming out and being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Sincerely appreciate it.
I'm excited to learn more about you, to chat. I don't know. Where do you want to start? Do you have a question right off the bat, babe?
Yeah, I just learned that you also record audiobooks.
Yeah.
So I guess first we should start with your name.
Okay, so my name is Matsu. I'm also from Utah.
And born and raised, right?
Yeah, so I'm from Cache Valley, northern Utah. And I've moved around the United States, but I'm back here again.
Back up north?
Correct. I'm in Brigham City now.
Nice.
Yeah.
Audiobooks.
Yeah, you said you record audiobooks.
Yeah, so basically I try to record one, like I have the same format as you guys do. I try to release a book at least once a week. So they're not my own books. I'm reading books of the Gaudiya Vaishnav literatures. So I come from an ancient lineage of yogis, of meditation practitioners of the bhakti tradition. So basically I've taken it upon myself as a service to look at the Gaudiya Vaishnav literatures, which is like a vast ocean, and take any of the literatures which have not yet been converted into the audiobooks and convert them into audiobooks. Because
nice.
a lot of bhakti practitioners before me have already taken the opportunity to record a lot of the books, which is important because I read a statistic once that I think something like 43% of humans don't read books anymore, only listen to them. So
you think that's accurate?
I don't know, but there is some merit to it.
Yeah, for
sure.
I
know from my own experience and from my experience with friends and family that, yeah, I would say, at least from just my observation of friends, let's take that, most just listen to audiobooks. Don't read at all, actually. Yeah.
So little reading anymore, huh?
Very much so. So it's good to take these books, which are like precious gems, and make sure that they're available to even those who don't read.
Are the books in English?
So they're in Sanskrit, okay, or Bengali, or mostly Sanskrit and Bengali. These are the two chief languages. And I read the translations. So there's one YouTuber, his name is Yashoda Kumar. His YouTube channel is Mantra Chance. And he does usually Sanskrit and English. But I find that just the English, it's a little bit more easy to get absorbed. So I just read the English translations of the original Sanskrit verses.
And is it just a lot of yogic practices and beliefs and everything like that in a sense?
Yeah. So it falls under the category of Krishna Katha. So there's two types of Katha or talk. One is Gramya Katha, which means like ordinary mundane talk or gossip. A lot of what we find in the newspapers of today. And then there's what's called Krishna Katha, which is pure transcendental sound vibration, discussing the nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. So the Vaishnav literatures fall under the category of Krishna Katha, pure spiritual sound vibration, which is sometimes referred to as Amrita Dhuni. And in Bengali, there's this nice verse that glorifies Krishna Katha, or the literatures of the Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition, as a nectar river, an eternal river of nectar, Amrita Dhuni.
Okay, we just went like super deep really fast with a lot of information.
Yeah.
And it's good stuff.
Yeah, we can break it down.
Well, I want to know more about you first. So you reached out. You've got a yoga studio up there in Brigham City.
Correct.
And what sparked my interest was this journey back and forth from Utah and India.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know more about... Steph and I both grew up here in Utah, so we're kind of well-versed in the culture of Utah. And you were born, not necessarily born, but you were raised here in Utah up north, mm-hmm, which is, you know, you said Cache Valley, which everybody in Utah who lives here knows what Cache Valley is and where Cache Valley is and everything like that. But it's a hub of the Mormon religion. And so I'm just curious, because everybody that grows up in Utah gets the same question, right? Mm-hmm. But are you Mormon, or did you grow up Mormon at least?
Yeah. So I was raised in the LDS church.
Okay.
And due to an internal dissatisfaction, I started researching other types of faith at a young age, which ultimately led me to the Eastern practices.
How old were you?
I was 14 when I really started to question not just the Christian faith or the Bible or the Book of Mormon, but the entirety of our Western culture. I felt like it ultimately led to dissatisfaction, no matter how I planned to look at it, or how I saw my life unfolding inside the context of Western culture. I felt like I was dissatisfied, and I would only have elongated unsatisfaction. So what was your question specifically?
Now I have more follow-up questions. I forgot my original question.
Please.
Was there something that sparked that questioning, that curiosity, and really not just in regards to religion, but like you said, Western society as a whole.
Yeah. I would just say it's the mercy of Krishna that I was dissatisfied, and I was intelligent enough to recognize I was dissatisfied and that I needed to seek answers, and that the present culture that was being presented to me was not it. So I would say it was due to causeless mercy. I'm not by any means different from anybody else, but for some reason or another, there was some causeless mercy. You could look at it like that. Some inexhaustible mercy.
Some what kind of mercy?
Causeless. So it's without cause. Okay. It's not because I have any qualification that makes me different from another living entity, but because mercy is causeless, I was, like I said, I was given enough intelligence to recognize that this is not going to satisfy me and I should seek satisfaction. Ultimately, I was led to the Eastern practices after researching, finding out what worked and what didn't work. I ultimately came to the practices of India or the Vedic practices.
What was the first thing that kind of sparked you in that direction? Because if you're starting to explore and question and look at everything, right, then you start to gather information.
Yeah.
What was the first thing that kind of sparked you to go in that direction?
It's a good question. I, at a young age, I was 16 years old, and I was, my parents thought it'd be a good idea for me to go to a wilderness training program. So I lived in the woods for a few months, and I really had a lot of what we called awakenings. We hear this word a lot in different traditions, but due to the totality or the conglomeration of all these awakenings I had, when I got back from Arizona, from the Anasazi Foundation, I had been turned on to a literature called the Tao Te Ching. And the Tao Te Ching was one of my first explorations into who am I and what is the goal of my life. And so in a nutshell, to answer your question, it's because of being yanked out of a box and the house and in the cities and being put out in nature in such a raw way, I really started to, you try it. You'll see what happens. It's right. A very profound experience, regardless of what background you come from or how intelligent or not intelligent you may be. If you spend a few months in Mother Nature, she'll do everything for you. She'll be like a guru for you.
Would you say that, I mean, I think that's beautiful to think that that was kind of what sparked it, was that reconnection to the planet, to Earth, to Mother Nature, and that kind of kicked everything off.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So like I said, I was exposed to the Tao Te Ching there and then came and researched the Tao Te Ching. Then I started researching Buddhism and Sufism and like that. That was where it all kind of unfolded, eventually leading to finding the, like I mentioned earlier, the Gaudiya Vaishnava literatures, or those books in pursuance of the teachings of Gaura Mahaprabhu. That's where we get the name Gaudiya. Because those of us who are following the Gaudiya tradition are following in the footsteps of Gaura Mahaprabhu, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we can get more into that also. But.
So at what point do you have like what you would classify as your first spiritual experience, where you start to recognize a connection to something greater than, you know, this physical realm?
Well, Anasazi, being in the woods like that, and ultimately, it was, I would say, when I came across one literature called the Srimad Bhagavatam. I didn't know anything about it. It was in some index of another literature I was reading, and it was a book that was referenced. I found it on Amazon, and I got it online. So the Srimad Bhagavatam, that was my first taste of what we call Ras, or the mellows of divine love. And after reading just a few verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam, my whole life was changed. It was everything I was looking for. In the Vedas, that said that every soul is seeking pleasure, seeking satisfaction. Anandam Buddhivar, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, that we're all seeking pleasure, and that pleasure is to be found in inquiry after the absolute truth. And I found this satisfaction in the literature of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And so that was my first taste of that, what I was seeking.
Take us to the first time that you go to India, and what was the spark for that?
So after years of studying the Srimad Bhagavatam and also having the opportunity to associate with people who were living the Bhagavatam. So there's the book Bhagavatam, and then go ahead.
You're okay. I just want to slow down because all of these words that you're using are going over my head. So I don't know if they're names of books, names of like gurus and spiritual teachers, random terms for trees and or the sky.
So Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavat Purana, is the literature which, if I ever do reference a literature this evening, it will most likely be Srimad Bhagavatam because it's considered the essence of all the teachings of India.
And that's what you're reading.
And that's Srimad, and everything is based off of Srimad Bhagavatam, a literature that is a sister or a brother, you could say, to the Srimad Bhagavatam is the more known Srimad Bhagavad Gita. So you've probably heard of the Bhagavad Gita. Uh-huh. It's also taught in schools and it's in different curriculums and colleges. So there's first the Bhagavad Gita, and then later after that, the postgraduate study is the Srimad Bhagavatam. So after reading the Srimad Bhagavatam and associating with those personalities which were also living and practicing the Srimad Bhagavatam, we have the book Bhagavat, which is the book, and then we have the person Bhagavat, which is the person that's living the teachings. So after associating with them, I found out about this glorious place called Sri Vrindavan that is an incomparable place here on earth. And I couldn't help but just be completely romanticized about going to Vrindavan. And that is what ultimately led me there, is due to hearing of Vrindavan through reading the Bhagavatam. Sorry, there's a lot of Sanskrit.
It's okay.
But it is a Sanskrit culture, right? It's coming from the Vedas, which is Sanskrit. Anyway, so I developed an insatiable urge to attain the land of Vrindavan, and I went to Vrindavan, which is this village inside of India.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is it just some sort of like, I mean, describe it. What is it?
So Sri Vrindavan is outside of New Delhi, at least geographically. We mm-hmm. could discuss like that. But really, the glories of Vrindavan are unparalleled, and we could go on for hours and hours discussing Srimad Bhagavatam and Vrindavan Dham. Dham means holy place. So of all holy places, Vrindavan is considered the best. And this earth is glorified out of all different planets in different planetary systems. This earth is considered very special because Vrindavan is manifest here. So it's also an offense to leave Vrindavan. To leave Vrindavan is considered an offense to Vrindavan because Vrindavan is such a glorious place that having attained it, one should try to stay there until your life airs leave your body. That is to say you die, quote unquote, die. But if you leave to spread the glories of Vrindavan, then it's not offensive. So for those of us who have attained Vrindavan and then once left, our desire is to spread the glories of this land of Vrindavan.
How old were you when you first went?
I was, I had just turned 23 years old. Okay. I went on my birthday, 22. I was there, like I got there in the middle of the night, and the next day was my 23rd birthday.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So to be specific.
How long did you spend there? And then have you gone back a couple of different times?
So I stayed there for a summer, and my desire is to go back every year until I move there. I have a tentative plan in the next 5 to 10 years to purchase property there, which I'm in the process of doing now. And I'm planning to shift there permanently and get Indian citizenship. So for the time being, taking every opportunity to spread the glories of Vrindavan is what I'm trying to do. And also on the material side of things, save up financially to be able to actually do something like that.
Move and set up camp there.
Correct. Yeah. Because you can't just do these things whimsically.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's best to, I'm sure you guys have noticed, it's best to plan for the future in a responsible, intelligent way. And those who don't usually have a hard time. There is a merit to being spontaneous, but at the same time, being regulated also has its place.
How did yoga play a role in this journey?
Well, yoga's more or less my first introduction to the Vedic culture, to the ancient traditional culture coming out of India. Vedic culture is that bona fide culture that is more or less being lost due to a materialistic society. So you could say ancient, undisturbed culture of India is the Vedic culture. And yoga, meditation were my direct links into that realm of the Vedic culture. So I started studying yoga, and I find it to be a really good avenue to introduce Westerners into the Vedic teachings, because sometimes we're a little bit more materialistically minded here. It's a materialistic society after all. So it's a little easier for people to adopt a practice of physical postures and breathing exercises. And then through that, there's what's called Dhriti Karana. We become purified by doing these things. And then with a little bit of purification, that desire, that spiritual desire, starts growing. And you start becoming naturally dissatisfied with material things. This is the natural outcome, a spontaneous, you could even say it's a byproduct of performing these practices as you're purified and you ultimately and develop an insatiable urge to understand who you are and what the goal of life is. If you're practicing with the right intention, right? Yeah. Srila Prabhupada, who's our teacher, our guru, the Jagat Guru, he said that it's not what you do, it's the consciousness in which you do it. So if you're doing it in a materialistic way just to get muscle, you know, your purification is very slow. But if you have the right consciousness when you undertake these practices, they'll purify you like anything.
I want to ask you not necessarily a philosophical question, but all the time we like just pose these different thought experiments because it's all just random stuff that flows through our head, right? And you said this world, or not this world, but this culture, Western culture and society, is a materialistic culture. And like expanding out from that, because I think that everything has a rhyme or reason on a bunch of different levels where it's not just one answer for every question. So the idea that we're a materialistic culture has some sort of like evolutionary standpoint of, you know, money has equaled safety throughout time and history, because if you have more money, then you have more opportunity to have a, I mean, whatever example of money was back in the day, right? Because obviously it wasn't money, but money equaled safety. And then it is, at this point in time, has become this monster that it is, in a sense, right? Because we're safe for the most part in society today. So that's one level of how and why I think that our culture is materialistic in nature. But do you think that there is a deeper meaning behind it, or a deeper reason behind it than just kind of that basic evolutionary standpoint?
Good. Yeah, the money is not the problem. It's just how we use the money, you know, just like anything. Like a phone isn't inherently bad, but it can go either way. Like, you could use the internet for bad, or you can also use the internet for good. So our materialist society, the objects and the things aren't necessarily the problems. Our advancements are very useful. Planes, trains, automobiles, very useful. But we're in an age what's called Kali. There's four different ages according to Vedic culture. And Kali, or Kali Yuga, Yuga means age, is a materialistically driven time on the planet. And it's inevitable. It's something that's bound to happen, destined to happen, and it's expanding. So we've been in Kali Yuga for tentatively 5,000 years. And Kali Yuga lasts much longer. So it's here to stay. And it will only get worse in a sense. But at the same time, simultaneously, we have the unfolding of beautiful practices such as the bhakti tradition, which are happening simultaneously with the increase of ignorance and materialistic society, in the sense of the material things are used just completely drowning us in a pool of nescience or ignorance. At the same time, paralleled with this, we have the awakening of the truths of the bhakti tradition happening due to the auspicious descent of one guru. His name's Srila Prabhupada. I brought him up earlier. Srila Prabhupada is the guru that brought us the bhakti tradition, the Gaudiya Vaishnav bhakti tradition from India. And then in the 1960s, he came here and he brought it to all of us here in the United States. So it's because of his mercy and his divine descent that any of us know about any of these things, or else we'd be more or less, you could say, doomed. But because of Srila Prabhupada's appearance in our lives and on this planet, we're very fortunate. He's created our good fortune. And so those of us who have found the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, who's just teaching what's in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the literature we were referencing earlier, we're very fortunate. We feel extremely fortunate, and we can't help but want to just spread those teachings to everybody else.
What do you think it is about humans that they, like, everybody we always want to tell somebody something about, like, something that we love or something that we're passionate about or something that we're into. Mm-hmm. Like, religion always wants to spread religion, and people that are passionate about their religion want to, you know, tell other people about it.
Yeah.
But it's not just with religion. It's not just with spirituality or different.
Just in general.
Just in general. Yeah. Like, it's like, if we like a TV show, we want to tell somebody about that TV show.
Yeah.
Or if you're like really into CrossFit, suddenly everybody that you meet, you have to tell about CrossFit, and you hope that they find CrossFit in their life because it's going to yeah. fix everything.
Have you seen Into the Wild?
Yes.
Well, you know how he when he passed away at the end of the movie, at the end of the book in real life, he famously wrote, "Happiness is only real when shared." Remember that famous quote from him? I think, don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure that it was right when he was passing away. You're right. He had eaten the poison plants. He's being paralyzed. And before he finally left his body, he wrote this, "Happiness is real only when shared."
What is that kid's name?
I don't know. That's why I was stealthily avoiding saying his name.
Shoot. I remember.
Talk amongst yourselves. I'm going to think of it.
You're going to think of it?
It's going to come back to me.
But yeah, just like that.
I like that idea that happiness is only real if it's shared.
Yeah. So that's the nature of these things. And I was actually thinking about this, this exact point. I was meditating this when I was driving here today. There's one verse in the, what's called the Bhakti Ratnakar, another Gaudiya Vaishnava literature. And it says one mystical thing, that bhakti, or devotion, divine love, is the property of every living entity. It's not like it's mine and not somebody else's. It's everybody's birthright. It's all of our intrinsic nature to experience this divine love, this awakening of bhakti. But it's only accessible when it's shared with others. So this is the mystical nature of bhakti specifically. And you were referencing that other things are like that also. That really the real relishment comes when you share it with other people. So bhakti is the same way also. Despite it being eternally all present in every sphere of the universe and in everyone's heart, still, it's only really accessible when you're sharing with other living entities and relishing that mellow of bhakti.
I like that idea of like, that not just happiness, but like love. Love is only real when it's shared, right?
Mm.
And it's like we can sit, because I'm picturing myself in like living completely by myself,
right?
Not like in a house, but long, long ago when you were just a single, you know, human running around by yourself and you got separated or whatever, it doesn't matter, but you're alone and you're in a cave and you're like, you feel all these different things, happy, sad, scared, excited, but there's kind of no context for them. And then there's like, I don't want to say there's any real joy, but do you remember like a really, really long time ago? This is like super off track.
Okay.
She'll remember it because it was a profound thing for me, but I had this, some sort of out of body experience. And I don't remember what in conjunction it was with, whether it was through somebody else doing some energy work or something like that, but it was me on another planet. And then like this version of me, do you remember this at all?
I'm believing so. I've got two moments in my head. So
yeah, but like I was some sort of like animalistic alien, something mm-hmm. or another on some other planet. And I ended up killing myself because I was so sad that I was alone.
That's right. Okay, So that was the first one that I was thinking. I was a past life regression that somebody was walking you through.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it's just the thought of like, you know, the silliness of like sharing a TV show that you like with somebody. I mean, that's like a base form of happiness and joy, right? Something that you like, something that brings you happiness and joy. You can even quote-unquote love a TV show, even though it's not the same kind of love that I'm talking about. But a lot of love and passion for something as materialistic and mundane and silly as a television show. But you want to share that love for whatever it is with whoever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how often do we sit and talk to people about, like, have you seen this show? You got to see this show. This show's so good.
True.
But yeah, it's just making me think that it's that is what it is the human nature is to share love.
Yeah.
Because I think probably in some way it's not real unless it is shared.
Yeah.
Like if you're alone by yourself and you're loving yourself and you're loving the nature and you're loving everything, like.
Like I see that very possible, very plausible. You would have that connection.
Mm-hmm.
But then if but somebody else.
So different, huh?
If all of a sudden here's somebody else on their own and it happens to be where you get to share that life together with somebody, and then you have that. I can see how much all of a sudden, like, the sun rises and everything would just become more beautiful.
Because it was shared.
Because now it's shared. Mm. I see that.
Yeah. Mm. There's a lot to be said about that. So, as you notice, it's not just in spiritual life, but in material life as well. So, nonetheless, here we are.
I like the idea that it's in some way, shape, or form, it's like a, like it's a small version of this big, beautiful thing where you want to, like, tell people about stuff that you're passionate about, because it's just like the smallest way of sharing a little bit of love with that person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So back and forth from India. Have you, I'm sorry, I don't know if it is back and forth. Did you only go the one time and then you're hoping to go back?
Yeah.
Okay.
So like I said, I have plans to go at least every year before I move there permanently. But I think it's good to be here in the United States and not to prematurely jump there, because the opportunities for sharing this are great. They're great here. And our teacher, Srila Prabhupada, he showed that by his own example. He was living in India. He was living in Vrindavan. He was there in the highest place doing the highest thing. But yet he left there to bring that to all of us. So following in his footsteps, he encourages his followers to also do the same, to not just prematurely focus on one's own advancement and one's own relishment of these high truths of the bhakti tradition, but also share them with others. So I had an opportunity was presented to me to purchase a yoga studio, and I thought, wow, this is it. Because I didn't seek it out. Nothing about the studio happened by force or by me doing anything, actually. It literally fell into my lap and just completely unfolded. So therefore, I knew that it was meant to be for some higher purpose, because I didn't seek it out. I didn't do anything. I just showed up and saw it through. So because of that, it happened. But if it weren't for that, then I probably wouldn't have been doing something else at some other place. Right?
Yeah.
But here I am. I'm still here in Utah, and I plan to be here. I'd like to open more studios because I find it's a good opportunity, like we were discussing earlier, to bridge the gap between Eastern culture and Western culture, because the Hatha yoga, the physical postures of yoga, are a beautiful opportunity for people to be inspired by the Vedic traditions from wherever they are, and then further go along. You know, it sparks some initial interest, and then you get some what's called shraddha, or faith in these traditions, and then you go further and deeper into these practices, which is an unlimited, it's referred to in Sanskrit literature as Kevala Ananda Kanda. It's ever expanding blissfulness. That's the nature of the Vedic practices, specifically culminating in the bhakti tradition. You guys are familiar with this term bhakti, right? You've heard bhakti?
Uh-huh.
Bhakti yoga. Yeah. Very, very popular nowadays. You know, very, like I said, despite being in Kali Yuga, we are, along with the materialistic society, we're also being brought all these beautiful practices.
Well, I like to play devil's advocate on this show too. And I'm sitting here thinking about, I mean, this is like an ancient tradition, right? Everything that you're talking about, the Vedic traditions and everything like that. I mean, they go back a very, very, very long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious if you have seen this or found this. I have no idea. It just makes sense that there's probably some faction of this where you have quote unquote people that practice this. Practice isn't even right, because over here in the United States and in Western culture, this is something that people gravitate towards and, you know, practice and become and learn and everything like that. But over in India, I'm assuming that it's just the way of life, right?
Mm.
So there's going to be culture and things like that where that's just the way of life. That's just how things are.
Yeah.
Do you have, or do you think there are, like quote unquote traditionalists that think that in some way, shape, or form, taking this message and taking, like, just for example, yoga and bringing yoga over here to the United States has in some way, shape, or form, like, bastardized it and made it this, you know, materialistic thing that has taken away from the purity of what it really is about? And, like, is there some faction of people that believe that we shouldn't be spreading this message and that we should be?
Cultural appropriation.
Well, not only a cultural appropriation, but like the way that it gets, westernized. And it takes away from the purity of what
this,
it really
this
truly
be
is.
Myself, as far as that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having the dilution happen of the practice or the internal purity. There's the external practice and then the internal practice, which is called Bahiranga, the external practice, and then the Antaranga, which is the internal atmosphere of what's going on when you're practicing. So anyway, not to get too into the details, but yes, I myself am fearful of this. And so I think it's very important that we stick to the tradition and base the practices off of three things. Guru, spiritual teacher. Sadhu, which also the guru is your spiritual master. Sadhu is just a spiritual person in general, a guide. And Shastra, which means the Vedic literatures. So through these things, we can make sure and stick on the right path and not be diverted into some diluted practice of the Vedic practices. So it's very important to stick to tradition and follow a bona fide spiritual master, not just anybody, but a bona fide spiritual master, someone who's actually steeped in wisdom of the absolute truth. Then the way is paved clear for you. And by their mercy, by their divine association, you will also realize those things in your own heart. But as soon as you sway and start basing things off of your own mental speculation and are following teachers who aren't bona fide, who actually don't have access to those inner recesses of truth, then you're also swayed. So we have to be very careful. Where are we sourcing our pramanam or our evidence? How do we know what is true or not true? That's very important for us to deliberate on. How do we know? Who is this author? How are they bona fide in any way opposed from this other author? Because there's so many varying opinions. So how do we sift through all of it? You know, it's very important because we can easily be led astray. It's Kali Yuga. There's so many people leading astray people. The blind lead the blind and they both fall in the ditch.
I feel like I'm just being inundated. Is that correct? Is it inundated? Inundated or unundated?
Inundated.
With all of these, like I said, I absolutely love playing devil's advocate at Dry Steph Crazy because I'll just sit there and argue with her about things that I believe the way that she believes or the way that she thinks, but I just like arguing the other side of it. But
yeah.
How long have you been at the yoga studio? How long have you had it?
Just 6 months.
6 months? Oh, yeah. Wow. It's new. This is a new venture for you. That's right.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, I was trained for some time. I had the opportunity to live in Denver with monks there. And so I lived there for several years. They more or less gave me the proper training to undertake something like that.
Then it happened.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I had it.
Sorry.
Western society. So this is another thought process that I'll try to unravel a little bit and explain. And keep in mind, this is like not just my own. I have a differentiation between thoughts and ideas and beliefs. Thoughts and ideas are just whatever, right? Random, so many different things, whatever pops into your head. And I'll hold on to a thought or an idea for an extended period of time, mulling it over and looking at it and testing it and basically just, you know, sitting with it for a very, very long time. And then eventually that thought or idea turns into a belief. And
I like that.
Beliefs are things that I hold true, that I kind of structure my existence in this existence with, right? And I think it's fair to say maybe 95% of the way there to a belief. It's pretty close to a belief. But energy, just the thing that connects us all, the thing that has been here and will continue to be here and is always here and is everywhere, just that, whatever you call that or whatever you reference that is, right? Just the life force of the universe. I think it's ever evolving and changing. I don't think it is a stagnant, one-sided thing. And I don't even think it's a thing with an infinite amount of sides in things. I think it's a continual kaleidoscope of evolution, and energy is always different. And part of the thing that I struggled with several years ago in regards to kind of learning different traditions and different thought processes. And was I felt like people were using traditions and beliefs from a linear timeline, and they were implemented and learned and taught during a phase of quote unquote energy on the planet.
Yeah, so we're learning according to time and circumstance.
Right. And then we're trying to apply those same thoughts and or beliefs on a different timeline for the planet where the energy is completely different. And so it's like trying to force something into a box that was created when boxes were important.
Yeah.
And now we don't need a box to hold whatever it is that we're trying to understand. That's just a real basic, easy way of looking at it, I guess. Yeah. But
it's a beautiful observation.
So I think about that. I think about all of the things that you're talking about in that Eastern tradition in regards to life, really. It's not even just in regards to spirituality, but it's in regards to life. And how much of it do you think, this is such a rabbit hole, because I was thinking about the process of bringing those traditions over here to the Western culture of the globe, right? And in some way, shape, or form, it's like we're spreading this message because it needs to reach as many people as possible because it's so beneficial. But what if we're spreading the message to get the materialistic aspect of Western culture, because that's what it's missing and that's what it actually needs? So it's not a detriment. It's actually the natural state of things where it's going to go towards this other thing that it's missing and lacking, because there is some component to it where if we're going to reach everybody with this, then we need the monetary. We need the ability to set up a silly podcast and throw it up on YouTube. And all these materialistic things help in the spreading of this message. So it's not something that we actually have to, I don't know.
Yeah, artificially do away. We don't have to renounce these things. They're very useful. That's a misconception that we often see in today's adaptation of Eastern practices.
That thought took me forever.
That's okay. I understood what avenue of thought you're going down. But yeah, these practices are eternally existing. So it's not like they were beneficial. I'm talking about the practices of the bhakti tradition. It's not like they were applicable 5,000 years ago when Krishna was on the planet, or 500 years ago when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was on the planet, or up until 1977 when A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada was on the planet. But 10,000 years from now, 50,000 years from now, 100,000 years ago, 100,000 years in the future, bhakti is an ever-present, ever-expanding ocean of bliss. And it's always all applicable, because it's the nature of the soul. Just like we have this word dharma, right? It's a common concept that's thrown around in Buddhist traditions and Hindu traditions. So we could break it down like this. A knife's nature is to cut. The nature of water is to be wet. It's this the intrinsic thing. That's just what it does. That's just what it is. In the same way, that's dharma. That's the dharma of the knife is to cut. The dharma of the water is to be wet and liquid. It's just the nature of the thing. So in the same way, our dharma, our svadharma, atma dharma, the dharma of who we really are is bhakti. So it's not applicable as some time ago or sometime in the future at all times and all circumstances. It's all applicable. So that's the beautiful nature of the bhakti tradition, which we find so accessible because it's for everybody. There's no qualification because of the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and his predecessors, that we don't need any qualification. They make our qualification. So despite us not knowing anything about who we are, what the goal of life is, they, by their merciful divine nature, they make us aware and they guide us and into reminding us of what's already there, not giving us anything new or concocting anything. It's just something that's there eternally that we've forgotten due to Maya or illusion.
What do you think, Ben?
Oh, I think of how many different ways this message is said, and how many different languages, how many different contexts. Everybody, so many things lead to this, which is everything is everywhere. We're all the same. We are all connected. It is everywhere. And this growth that is always in, like this mm-hmm. inner truth that we're all connected to. And it doesn't matter what you believe or not, it's there for everyone. So yeah. How much of it is like, do you think everybody's talking about the same exact thing, but everybody calls it by a different thing?
Yeah, just like the sun, right? We call it the sun. In India, they call it Surya or Surya Dev. And in Roman culture, they called it something else. And another culture at another place, they called it another thing. But it's not. Only a fool would say it's a different sun. So in the same way, if the integrity is there of the practitioner, of the aspirant, what we call a sadhaka, and as someone aspiring for the truth, if that integrity is there, then it's the same for everybody. But some people use the name of religion to concoct their own nonsense and to mislead people. So that's not this, that's not talking about the same sun. But it, provided that integrity is there, we're talking about the same thing. And some people know more about the sun and some people know less. Like some people have never researched the sun. They don't know anything about the sun. And some people, they've spent their whole life and gotten degrees and investigating and discussing these things and the nature of the sun and how hot the surface is. And they're very well educated. So there's varying degrees. Although it's the same absolute truth, still, according to the individual, there's varying understandings. Just like the sun unlimitedly spreads its rays on everybody and doesn't distinguish. But the sunflower grows very quickly, whereas a pine tree takes many years. So
the relationship's no different.
Yeah. Say that again.
The relationship isn't any different.
Yeah.
Based off of how much information you have.
Yeah.
And how little you have.
Yeah.
The relationship that you have with the sun isn't. Yeah, it's the same. You get the same amount of sunshine.
Correct.
You will get the same amount from the sun, regardless of how much information you know. Your appreciation may be different.
Exactly.
But what your connection.
The sun's always going to shine.
The sun's always going to shine.
But the problem is people close the blinds. So the idea is we just have to open up the blinds and let the sun in. Because, you know, the absolute truth isn't picking, oh, this person and this person. But because like the sun, it's shining equally on everybody. It's not distinguishing country from country. So in the same way, Krishna, the supreme absolute truth, he's manifesting, he's there for everybody. But we close the blinds and we, by our own volition, our own misused independence, we become adverse and we become what's called Bahir Mukh, which means we turn our face away from the sun of Krishna, and we therefore fall into illusion. And we can stay in illusion for a very inconceivable amount of time, birth after birth. But if we, by some fortune, come in contact with the spiritual master, we can know about the nature of illusion and who we are. And by their mercy, we can come out of the darkness and open the window and let the sun shine in. So that's the power of association, which is another important point, who we associate with. I was just talking with a friend of mine this morning. Show me your friends, I'll show you your future. Who you associate with, you become like. Association is extremely powerful. So we should be very wise with our decision-making on who we choose to associate with, you know, because some people will lead us down an alternative path. Just like if you're trying to get into rock climbing and you hang out with bicyclists, you're going to naturally, by nature of that association, you'll also want to be a bicyclist and you'll get the gear.
Worst rock climber.
Yeah.
Say, what if the bicyclist, that's always hard for me to get out. What
right.
The bicyclists want to then be rock climbers. Doesn't mean that you're going to follow. You might be the
right.
Leader.
It depends. That's right. It can go either way. So who's associating with who? That's an important point too. But yeah, the weaker party automatically follows the stronger party in that situation. So yeah, taking association, sometimes you're giving association, and therefore it's beneficial for the other person. So it can go either way. That's a beautiful point. Yeah.
So you ready for the million-dollar question?
Please.
So the world's a clusterfuck, right? There's a bunch of pretty much anything and everything going on all the time, and it's in some way, shape, or form, whether it's global warming or war or whatever, it's just a shit show. If you could pick, this is why that's a million dollar question, right?
Don't try and say
one thing that you feel like is going to change that. Like if there is one, not necessarily message, but one act, one thing that could shift and change the direction that we are headed, or maybe we're not headed in that direction.
Yeah. Well, let's keep going down this vein of thought that we brought up, this idea of the sunshine. It's very applicable. Similes are very applicable, and they help us understand greater concepts. Like we were talking about, we have to turn our face towards the sun. It sounds simple, and it is a simple thing. That's how we do it. That's how we can stop the degradation and what's happening. Look what's happening in the world. Look at what's going on in the world.
It is crazy.
You know, especially now. And this is nothing compared to what it will be like in the future.
So what do you do for the people? Once again, this is just devil's advocate. What do you do for the people that first and foremost aren't aware of the sun? So that you say, turn towards the sun. I have no idea what the hell you're talking about. Or the people that refuse to, right? Because the whole idea that we just have to get everybody to wake up in a sense and to see this bigger, beautiful picture, and somehow that's going to shift and change everything. I fully agree that if suddenly we could snap our finger and tomorrow everybody thought about the person next to them, right? If everybody thought about the people on the other side of the planet as much as they think about their loved ones, then I think we'd be in a lot better shape. But how do we go about doing that? Like, what is something that could be done? What's a seed that could be planted today that is going to bear fruit?
Beautiful.
50-100 years from now.
Beautiful question. Beautiful. Because not only are the answers important, but perfectly posed questions are maybe, you could even say, more important. So anyway, that's how a good conversation takes place, is not only good answers, but perfectly posed questions. So that's a beautiful question.
I don't know if it's perfectly posed, but I'll take it.
It's a step in the right direction. That's humble of you to say. But okay, the answer is kirtan. Have either of you ever heard of kirtan? Kirtan.
I've heard that word before, kirtan. But I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Okay. So kirtan, that's the ticket. This is the snapping of the fingers, how to wake everybody up. Kirtan is the congregational chanting of the divine name of Krishna. And it was made famous by Srila Prabhupada and his predecessor, a personality we were discussing earlier, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This process, it does not take into consideration anybody's qualification, and it brings one swiftly, with one swoop, to the highest perfection of life. And it's equally applicable for everybody. So this kirtan process of getting together with others and chanting, not just chanting any damn thing, but chanting Shabda Brahman, pure transcendental sound vibration. This is the main way that's described in Vedic literatures and echoed by the gurus coming before us. Hadranama eva kevalam, by the name of Hari, or Krishna, or Ram, Govinda, Shamsundar, like that. There's many names. By taking the time with others to absorb yourself with oneself, which is called japa meditation, which is where you take the name of Krishna on one's tongue in your seclusion, but you know, with your own self. And then there's what's called sankirtan, which means with others. So this sankirtan process is the main way which we can bring everybody to the perfection of life very quickly and easily. So this is the secret. This is the key to unlock the door. And so it's very important that we engage in this process as often as possible. And it goes like this. There's many mantras that kirtan is done with. You could say innumerable. There's so many different mantras. But it's described in Vedic literatures. There's one mantra that embodies all other mantras. It's the Mukhya mantra, or the chief sound vibration that embodies all transcendental sound vibrations. And it's the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. It has 16 names and 32 syllables. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So this is the Mukhya mantra, which is recommended for every living entity during this age to take the opportunity to absorb ourselves in this transcendental sound vibration. And it will unlock the door of the highest esoteric truths very quickly. This is the nature of kirtan.
But how do we get the people that don't? I always think about, like, I mean, reality as we think about it in regards to this podcast, where how do you get people to listen that don't want to listen? How do you get people to hear that don't want to hear? How do you frame things in such a way? Like, if we go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth at trying to agree upon that this is a soda can, or this is an aluminum can, mm-hmm. or this is just a can, how do you get people that don't want to see it, that aren't willing to look at it, that don't want to hear it? how do we get them to even come to the table and have the conversation first?
It's a good question. It's a good question because, like, look at my own life. I didn't meet anybody that was practicing a bhakti tradition. Somehow or another, we were discussing divine mercy. Somehow or another, Krishna from within, the super soul within, the Lord within the heart will guide you and he'll bring you that way. But yeah, you can artificially make somebody, but we can logically look at these things. Like, for example, let's take an example. So, practical example. So once I was distributing meditation books on the campus of Fort Collins in Colorado, and I offered a book to a cowboy, somebody who wouldn't generally be interested in Vedic teachings. And he was nice, but he turned it down. And he said, no, not really. Some reason, the super soul within, Krishna from within my heart, encouraged me. No, remind him that, like, I was like, okay, what will you get a degree and get married and have a nice car and color TV and house and then what? And he's like, yeah, that's probably what I'll do. And I was like, okay. And then inevitably your wife will die. Inevitably you will also die. And then what's it all? I mean, not verbatim, this isn't what I said, but I was barking up this tree. I was not in a pessimistic way, but this is the reality of the material world. Everything goes through six stages. It's born. There's some growth. There's some sustenance where it sustains for some time. It produces some offspring and then it dwindles and ultimately perishes. And we can't escape from this. This is the nature of everything in the material realm. So I discussed this with him briefly. And he became so inspired. It was like the first time he had ever thought about it. And he was like, you know, you're right. Even if I get the most beautiful wife and even if I get all these things, they're all temporary. So really, what's it all about? And I was like, well, here you go. Like, I had a book called The Science of Self-Realization that discusses just that. And he eagerly took the book and he gave a handsome donation for the book for the cost of the printing. And just like that. So he wasn't interested. And it doesn't always work like that. But in that case, I was influenced. I was encouraged from within. I felt a prompting from within to encourage him and to make him look at things soberly, not pessimistically, but these are the realities of the material world. Nobody can deny. Nobody can deny. No scientist, no religionist anywhere will deny. And if they do, they're a fool, because this is the nature of the material world. It's temporary place. And because of that, it should, in any intelligent person, spark some detachment. And not only some detachment, but spark an interest in who am I really? What is the goal of my life? All these things are temporary, offering temporary results that I can reap the fruits for some time, but no matter what, they'll go away. So in a short answer to your question, if we're presented with an opportunity to discuss these types of topics with somebody who's inherently not interested, we can just soberly look at things. There's no reason to get into far esoteric teachings. We can just look at the reality in the material world. And if somebody has a little bit of what's called sumedha saha, or good brain substance, intelligence, they can see for themselves that you're right. This is a temporary place and I should find out what is the goal of my life. So if that answers your question, just to kind of give you an example. And
have you figured out first what the goal of your life is, and then also what is the purpose of life?
Well, not to my own intelligence, not to my own merit. I'm an insignificant fool. But because Srila Prabhupada is so merciful, he's given this. He's introduced us into these things and gave us an understanding of who we are and what are the goal of our life is. And we could go on about this because this is the most important subject matter. Look, we have 3.3 million people in Utah. How many people are coming together to discuss these things? What is the goal of life? And like that specific thing. This is called in Sanskrit paramartha or prayojan. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, whose Gaura, we're following the teachings of Gaura Mahaprabhu. So we're Gaudiya Vaishnavas. We're following his teachings. So it's good that we reference his authority because after all, we're following in his footsteps. So he said, premo pum arto mahan, that the goal of life, Arto, the goal, is prema, divine love. And this is the teaching of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he gives the process with which to awaken that divine love, which is premanam, kirtan, like we were discussing earlier. This is the ticket to achieve the goal of life, prema pum arto mahan, which is ever expanding divine love. So to reference authority and give you a short answer to your question, love, divine love is the goal of life.
Yeah.
Ever expanding, blissful, divine love.
Yeah.
The highest thing. We're all seeking it. We're all seeking it, but we don't know where to find it because everything here is temporary. But Chidiyan Mahaprabhu and those following in his footsteps like A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada have given this prema without any consideration of our qualification, have given it freely to everybody.
I feel like it's everywhere. Not just that, just like...
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you can find divine love here.
Correct. It is.
With people, with...
Correct. Yeah.
I don't feel like...
It's ever expanding and ever... It's there's not a place that it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But it's up to the individual's capacity to access it. Right? Like, it's an ever-existing eternal fact that that's our nature, is to be lovers and to be loved, to have a lover and beloved, not just in a relationship in the material world, but just in general. The love and be loved is the inherent tendency of the soul. So you're right. Like, it's everywhere. That can't be not found in any sphere of life.
That's what happiness is, or when you're able to share it.
Yes.
Sorry.
Experiencing love and sharing love with others.
Oh, I got the wobbly chair. I'm trying not to be wobbly.
Does it make a noise?
Yeah, I'm over here. It's fine.
No worries.
I'm doing my thing.
But yeah, beautiful question. More people would be better off if more people were asking questions such as that.
I think when it comes to me, or when it comes... Me personally, when I think about it, I think one of the problems is that people have a misunderstanding of what love is. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to grasp that love is something. Because, I mean, the reality is that love is a material thing. Love is it's a thing that can be described and defined in 1,000 different ways. And then when you try to explain it in such a way that love is this greater thing that exists, love is this thing that is the purpose of all, as well as the thing that we're all heading towards and the thing that spins everything, then it becomes really difficult to, I think, for some people to stretch their mind to that extent of what love is, because it has a more practical sense. So it's always like, how do we explain that practical understanding of love is the bigger understanding as well, right? Like, it's really easy for people to understand love between their family, between their children, between each other, their partners, and things like that. But then to expand that outwards, where suddenly it becomes everything, as well as the meaning of everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we can look at the relationship between a mother and a son, or a mother and her children. That love is very it's very selfless and unmotivated. I can look at my own life. No matter what I were to do or who I were to become in my life, my mother would love me unconditionally. So this gives us insight, some of these relationships in the material world, although they're in the material world, it gives us insights into some of the deeper natures of divine love. So this is, you know, a pale reflection of the greater divine love, which is accessible when one is completely purified of all material contamination. Because as long as we're still materially contaminated, our capacity to love is thwarted or hindered. Although we're loving beings and our nature is to love and want to be loved, still we have to be purified in order to fully access that completely, if that makes sense. So the process of purification is necessary, because although it's in our inherent nature, still somehow or another, we've become contaminated living in the material world. So therefore, the question is how to purify oneself. And then it comes back again to the process of kirtan. Transcendental sound vibration is something we find in every tradition of chanting God's names. We find it in the Christian tradition, the Buddhist tradition, etc., etc. So it's something that we see everywhere. The importance of sound is amazing. By sound, you can become elevated, and by sound, you can become degraded. By sound, you could, you know, you can even shatter glass, or you hear a sound vibration of a loved one passing away. How powerful is that sound vibration? How much it affects you? What to speak of? These are material things. What to speak of? Pure amala, amala harinam, or pure spotless sound vibration. of Krishna's name. So coming back again to the process of kirtan, because that is, after all, the main contribution of the bhakti tradition. This is how we gain access into understanding the nature of divine love, because in a contaminated state, it's very difficult for us to understand the full nature of love. It's inconceivable. And we can sit and deliberate it all we want, but the best thing to do is to taste it, right? I think George Harrison said the proof of the taste of the pudding is in actually tasting the pudding. If you've never had pudding before, the best thing, you could sit and speculate, oh, it's like this or like that, but still, nonetheless, if you taste it, then you'll know. The proof of the pudding is in the tasting. So in the same way, when we're talking about prema, when we're talking about the goal of life, when we're talking about divine love, the best thing is to taste it. And the best way to taste that divine love is twofold. Shravanam, which means to hear the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, and kirtanam, which means to chant, like we were discussing earlier, chiefly chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra.
I think we could probably go on forever, because I can't, I've got so many questions that I think I could continue to ask, but we have to wrap, unfortunately. Before we do, though, is there anything that you want to throw out? Where can people find you? I know you said the yoga studio's been open for 6 months.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So we're located in Brigham City, and that's between Ogden and Logan, for those of us who might not be so familiar. Very small town. We're the only yoga studio there. We're on Google, Facebook, Instagram. If you ever want to come check out our classes, we have classes 7 days a week. So anytime you find yourself in the area, that's an avenue.
What's the name of it?
The Yoga Pit. So we're on, like I said, those different platforms I mentioned under the Brigham City Yoga Pit. And where I release my audiobooks is on the YouTube channel called Revolution of Sound. And that's where the audiobooks are found. So, but mostly, this is my own insignificant contribution. But the contribution is really from A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. And so for those who are interested, whoever do hear this sound vibration through this mic, and they are piqued in their interest to understand the bhakti tradition, the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, the best thing to do is to get Srila Prabhupada's books. And we've discussed several of them already, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. He wrote commentaries. So these books, Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita, have been existing for thousands of years. But he wrote commentaries. So there's a verse, and then he gives an explanation, or what's called a purport.
Okay.
So those purports are everything. And that's where we find the nature of bhakti and love expanded on infinitely. So those are the avenues which, with a seeker, can seek these things out, is at the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada.
Awesome.
And easy to find. Easy to find. Google Srila Prabhupada, you can find. He wrote over 60 books, and his contribution is unparalleled.
Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. Sincerely appreciate it. And it was beautiful meeting both of you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Money is not the problem. It's just how we use the money. It has shown up and saw it through. Develop an insatiable urge to understand who you are and what the goal of life is. Happiness is real only when shared.